about the delay here. I'm going to try to keep to Doug's directive. So if I had a full hour, I wanted to actually talk about four different things that are related to planet migration. But in keeping with Doug's directive, I'm only going to talk about the first of these. Then I'm going to talk about the giant planet migration problem using both distortion and planet scattering. There's three other sub-problems that are related to this that I'm just going to mention. One is that you can do type 1, sit down, Hal. You could do type 1 migration with turbulent fluctuations. And you could do the scattering of solar systems to put constraints on the birth cluster of our own solar system, and you can also study the long-term stability of Earth-like planets and binaries. Now, what all of these problems have in common is that they don't actually have an answer. And what I mean by that is, I think, familiar to this group, namely that whenever you have such a complicated and chaotic dynamical system, such as a solar system, you don't get an answer, but rather you get a distribution of answers. So if you ask the question, given a solar system, where are the planets going to end up at the end of the migration? You don't get an answer, right? The only intelligent way, well, in my opinion, the way to answer that question is to say, well, what's the distribution of possible outcomes? And we need to be careful, I think, to phrase our results in those terms. So back to the problem at hand. You've seen all of this before. We have found lots of extrasolar planets, as Chaz has talked about. And there's two things, or at least two things, that we want to understand about them. There's a distribution of semi-major axes, or A. So whenever I refer to A or where the planet is, I'll be talking about the semi-major axis. And we also want to explain the eccentricities. So that's the problem, namely, how do you get a theory which produces the distribution of A and E, semi-major axis and eccentricity? And here's, I think, the answer. So here's the general paradigm that I want to explore, and then we'll fight about it during the discussion time. Namely, let's look at the migration scenario. There's historically at least two ways to make planets move around. One is called disk torques, and the other is called planet scattering. But disk torques, we have a disk that's surrounding the planets. The disk is has some kind of accretion flow, and it's moving the planets inward. Now, in gross terms, a disk like migration scenario is very good for changing the location of the planet, and it's rather poor for changing the eccentricity. But as you saw in the previous slides and you have in your minds, we need to explain both movement in A and E space. Now, planet scattering is the idea that when you make a planet, you're likely to make lots of them, or at least two of them, and that the planets will scatter off of each other as they evolve. Now, this is good for changing the eccentricity, as I'll show. And it's not so good for changing the semi-major axis. So the argument is simply that, well, the disk is going to be present anyway because you formed the planets out of them. You're going to form more than one planet anyway, as we just saw. So the only natural thing to do is to ask, what happens when I put the two of them together? Now, to focus this discussion, I want to make very clear what I mean here. When I say that disk torques are poor for explaining the eccentricity, I'm not saying that there is no evolution in eccentricity. There are ways for the disk torques to actually pump up the eccentricity a little bit. There are also ways for the disk torques to damp down the eccentricity a little bit. And that's a problem that I'm only going to import other people's results from. I haven't actually done an honest calculation of myself. That's something that needs more work. What I will show you in some detail next is why it is that planet scattering by itself is not a good way to change the semi-major axis. So to answer that first question, people had done a long series of calculations using two and three planets and found that in their numerical experiments, they could not move the semi-major axis of the planet in very far. So as a way to test that in more detail, I decided to do a long series of 10-planet scattering simulations where you place 10 planets down on initially circular orbits in the range where our giant planets are. So these are very chaotic and very dynamically active systems. The idea being that this is about as most extreme kind of planet that you want to consider. And if these won't give you the semi-major axis distribution that you want, then presumably nothing will. So the results are given in terms of four different initial mass functions for the planet. So you have random planet masses with one Jupiter mass, with two Jupiter masses, planets with a random mass distribution and planets with a log random mass distribution. So I used John Chambers' Mercury code and just ran hundreds of simulations for each case. So one result that you get is that you can consider these planets sort of like an atomic nucleus, right? If you have a solar system with 10 planets, there's a time it takes to eject a planet. But if you do 100 simulations, again, you get 100 different answers. Each solar system won't eject its first planet at the same time. So if you ask the question, given an initial condition, what's the time required for a planet to be ejected, then that question doesn't have an answer. But if you ask the question, what's the half-life of that system, then you do get an answer. And here are the four different mass distributions plotted in such a way that a straight line means that it's following a half-life, and that the slope of this line determines the half-life of the system. Now, you can go ahead and mine the results and do this for the daughter products and so on and so forth. But again, the fact that these things are so highly chaotic slightly changes the way in which you ask the questions. Now, most of you know this already, but I'm just sort of clarifying the discussion. The other thing that you get is that you get distributions of the final orbital elements. So if you run these simulations to a million years' time or 10 million years' time, you get a nice distribution of eccentricity. That's for all of the planets that are left. You can also do the distributions for the orbital elements of the innermost planet, because those are the ones that are most likely to be seen by the observers. Yes, Sam? Oh, the half-life, I mean, it's like a decay. A decay is the ejection of a planet.
The
planet. Yeah.
So first
the first planet. What I showed you. What I showed you, where was that? Here. This is the time it takes for the first planet to be ejected. So to be specific, you start with a 10-planet system. There's some time required for the first planet to be ejected. Then you're left with the daughter product, which is a 9-planet system. There's an analogous plot, not shown here, that will tell you the decay time of the 9-planet system, and so on. And of course, it gets messier as you go on, but this is just the first step. Okay.
Can you characterize what difference is among your initial ensemble? Because I would think that if you have things that are very similar versus not very similar, you're going to get a different current.
Oh, well, yeah, the half-life must depend on what you use as your ensemble of initial states. These initial states are, you put 10 planets down at random in circular orbits, where random means log random in semi-major axis over the range of the giant planet region in our solar system from 5 to 30 AU. And then their azimuthal angle or whatever phase angle units you like to work in are then chosen randomly as well.
They're all the same mass?
Well, there's four different mass distributions. That's sorry, I was going fast because I was trying to. What's that? Okay. So this isn't actually the most interesting part of it. So let me go on. what's that? Oh, the length scale on that plot was about 100,000 years. Okay, that's the whole axis. Okay. So, sorry, I was going too fast and confusing you. If you look at the innermost planet's location in the AE plane, you see, for the four different mass distributions, we have four different symbols, okay? But you see that there's this striking wall here. This is the basis of my statement that planet scattering by itself is not a good or not a sufficient method of moving the semi-major axis, okay? What's that? Inward, yes. Yes, that's where we see them, Hal. Is in.
Okay. We started at 10 AU.
We started at 5 AU.
We started at 2 AU, which is possible.
Yeah, no, I'll get to that. The point is that you see this wall, and it cries out for an analytic explanation, right?
Yes.
So let's do that. It's just the lead. So what I'm going to give you now is an astronomer's proof of why there's a wall there. And by astronomer's proof, you'll see what I mean, because... Well, we'll start with the beginning. The starting energy of a planet is its binding energy, which is given in terms of its initial semi-major axis. Now, what I'm going to imagine is that I'm going to focus my attention on that planet, and I'm going to consider a field of scatterers which will be moving that planet around. Now, one scattering event changes the energy by this amount, where I'm assuming that the best you can do is to have the scattering body of mass mu give all of its energy, or take away all of its binding energy worth of energy from the initial thing. So I'm implicitly assuming here that the best you can do is to have the scattering body scattered out of the solar system, but it's not taking away a huge amount of positive energy. So that's my assumption, which is keeping it from being a rigorous proof. Now that's actually something that happens in practice, because in practice things are bouncing around and they're much more likely to leave the system with zero energy than, because that's a much more likely event than for them to leave the system with a large positive energy. Okay, so that's where I have the assumption. So after one scattering event, the semi major axis of the planet that I'm moving changes by this amount. After n scatterers, it changes by this to the nth power. Now I can write, what I care about is the total mass in the scattering body. So I'll write the mass of scatterers as ms divided by the mass of the planet. And this is the mass of the planet, it's ms over n, where n is the number of scatterers, and I have this to this power. So this is the factor by which I move the planet after n scattering events.
But Fred, this is all based on close encounters. What if you go through many sequences of resonances? In fact, you can exchange energy a lot more than this.
Well, this actually explains the plot that I just showed you.
But these are close encounters.
Yes.
If you do it through resonant plotting, you can actually do a lot more.
Well, you can change a lot of
the angular
momentum.
No, you can also change a lot of the energy. Resonant hopping means you change the energy. Secular effect, you change a lot of angular momentum.
But in the end, you can't
do better
than
throwing
them all out.
Yeah.
Well, you can also get a very, total energy has to be conserved of the system. So whoever you throw out has to go in.
Well, that's what I'm assuming here that.
But this is all close encounters, right? These are all what you describe here. It's the maximum amount of energy that you can actually get by raising conditions. But in fact, things get sent in. They can't move to different locations through resonant pumps.
Well, the only assumption I'm making here is that the scatterers have a certain amount of energy that they can take away, which is their binding energy. So in order for this not to be valid, you have to have the scatterers somehow leave the system with much more than their binding energy, a large positive energy. Yeah, so it's just a conservation of energy argument. Now let's see where it goes, and we can come back to this in the discussion time. If you look at this function as a function of n, the best you could do is to make n go to infinity, to scatter off a lot of little things. That's the most efficient. And when you do that, you see you discover E, right? In the limit n goes to infinity, you get the exponential function. And what that tells you is that the mass of scatterers you need to move a planet is related to the amount that you want to move it, okay? So here you see that right away there's a problem. If you want to move a planet, a factor of semi-major axis is much bigger than unity, then you need a mass in scatterers, in scattering bodies, that's much bigger than the mass of the planet you're trying to move. That would mean that you need mass of the planet inside already. But that doesn't do you any good, right? The whole reason why you want to move the planets from the outside to the inside is that there are no planets inside. If there's already a lot of planets inside in the inner solar system, you don't need to move any from the outside. So you can, and you can also see that in the simulations I showed you, this factor that we saw was about 5. And the log of 5 is a little bit about 2. So that the mass of the scatterers that you have to move the planets in the way I set up the simulations actually makes sense. Now, just to complete the problem, if you ask the question, given that you want to set up a disk that has the maximum scattering properties, according to this simple analytic argument, you get a particular preferred surface density distribution. This is the surface density. This is the way you would want to arrange your surface density distribution to get the maximum inward scattering. So the whole point of this was simply that you can't move planets in very efficiently through scattering alone. So what I'm going to do next is to show you, or to demonstrate, a proof of principle that if you do have multiple planet systems, and I'll focus here on two planet systems, and you have disk torques, then the combination of those two can in fact fill the AE plane more or less like how the observations fill the plane. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to start with two planets. The first period will be at, just because I had to start somewhere, at 1900 days. The second period will be irrational number times that. It's as irrational as you can get in double precision code because you don't want to start near a resonance. And it will be, for those of you who have done this problem or similar problems, this will be outside the 3-to-1 resonance, okay? Now, I'll choose the planets initially from a random mass distribution, and then later on I'll choose them from a log random mass distribution. I'll set the viscous evolution time of the disks to be 0.3 million years. This is the viscous evolution time for the inner solar system, so it's sort of a reasonable amount. I'll allow for planetary collisions where I'll choose a cross-section corresponding to the planets being twice Jupiter's radius. I'll include the relativistic corrections, which means that you take into account the perihelion advance of the inner planet, which can move things out of resonance, although it's a small effect here. We'll include tidal interactions with the central star, which again affects eccentricity when you're close to the star. And then the other thing is that after we'll run the simulations until either we reach a million years or one of the planets is ejected, but after the first planet's ejected, the disk is still there. So to account for further evolution, I'll take the disk to have a random lifetime, a random number corresponding to its lifetime, so it can shove the planet in a little bit further after that. Now, the big unknown in this is what happens to eccentricity. Most people tell you that the disk torques have the effect of damping the eccentricity. So I'll use initially two different eccentricity damping timescales. And when you do that,
just to be sure, you don't solve the electrodynamic equation. You just plug into your equations analytic formula for type 1, type 2 migration.
No. What I'm doing, I have a Brewer store integration code doing a, two-body dynamics. I put in the disk torques as a force term. I put in the eccentricity as another force term. And I put in, the relativistic correction to tidal interactions as additional force terms. So it's just a three-body simulation with lots of extra forces. Okay? It's not an honest finite difference fluid description of the disk. I'm importing those results from people who have done that previously. Okay?
Logic, why do you have two planets and one equals one?
Well, that's the whole point of it. One planet...
That's what I'm missing, yeah.
Oh, well, the point is that what happens in practice is that you're only exerting a torque on the outer planet. So it surfs its way inward until it locks in some kind of resonance with the inner planet and moves them both in together. But as they move both in together, they vibrate around, and eventually they pump up the eccentricity. And usually the most common result is that one of them will leave the system. And what you get is this. Here you see three different sets of dots. One is the observed planets. One is the results of these kinds of simulations with an eccentricity damping timescale of 0.3 million years, the same as the viscous damping timescale. And the others with a slightly longer eccentricity damping time scale. And the point is that you can fill the AE plane nicely by taking into account the two effects, namely disk torques and planet scattering. And more or less, you can fill the plane in the same way that the observed planets fill the plane. Now here we have a bit of a problem. Well, this is preliminary in the sense that we don't really know what the parent population of the planets were that got you to this. We don't know quite what the selection effects are. So comparing the two distributions in detail is a little premature. But the point is that with this mechanism, you can fill the whole plane in more or less the same way. Now, to do this, to begin with, Laughlin and I did this, and we used random masses, as in we just chose the mass to be random, a random number between 0 and 5 Jupiters. That's not quite the right thing to do because we now think we have some idea of what the mass distribution of the planets are. So I'm having a student redo this, where she's using a log random mass distribution to start with. So you choose the mass logarithmically between the 10th and 10 Jupiter masses. And here again, you get, here's one plot and here's the next plot. You can still, you can still fill the AE plane in more or less the same way that the observations do. Here I think the red ones are the theory and the blue are the observed ones. And just to show you what happens to the mass, you have a tendency to scatter out the smaller ones. So if you start with a perfectly flat log random mass distribution, then the final mass distribution is shown here. You see you tend to scatter out the little ones and retain the big ones a little bit. But it's a relatively modest effect in its almost equal opportunity mass scattering. So this is where I'm out of time. So let me just conclude. The point I'm trying to make here is that I think that planet scattering by itself gives you all the eccentricity you want very efficiently through direct numerical integration and through the analytic back of the envelope calculation I gave you, whether you believe it or not, and Doug does not. You can show that you don't change the semi-major axis enough to explain what you see. Disk torques can provide the A, that's long known, but there's no explicit demonstration that they give you the right eccentricity. So what I'd like to argue is that the disk torques with the planet scattering fill the AE plane as observed. So that's my 20 minutes. We'll see how this discussion works.
Let's discuss that issue rather than going over it for other issues. Okay. Maybe we can have some discussion.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little louder?
Yeah, I can't hear you.
Hold on just a second.
We're taking two planets, and
we're
taking the torque, which is acting out of those planets.
Yes.
Drives it in towards the innermost planet.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand why you're getting any scattering in that scenario at all, because most of the previous studies of that situation tend to create a system which is locked in a mean motion resonance, usually the 2-1 resonance. Why is it that you're not getting resonant locking, you're getting scattering instead?
Well, you do lock and then you scatter, and the way I set these up is that you first, since I started them outside, I go into the 3-1 resonance first.
3-1.
Yeah, the 3-1. If I started them closer together, I could get into 2-1, but I started in the 3-1. Most of the time, it will stay in 3-1 for a while. But as you continue to push on the outer planet with the disk and move the two planets in together, they are in more or less 3-1 resonance, and then they start vibrating about that until one of them gets enough.
Right. I think the reason why you're getting that result, though, is you've taken extremely long eccentricity damping times, which perhaps, I think they're too long, if you don't mind me saying so. You've got a migration time of around 0.3 million years.
Uh-huh.
And you've got eccentricity damping times of 1 to 3 million years. Now,
no, it's 0.3 to 1. It's 1 and 0.3.
1
so,
and 0.3.
So I'm taking the eccentricity damping time scale. I've taken it from infinite, so no eccentricity damping, all the way down to the same time scale as the accretion time scale. And you get it in all of those cases.
Probably you should even have smaller eccentricity damping timescales, is my feeling. If you look at simulations based on what happens when you have an initially eccentric planet and how quickly the disk damps the eccentricity, it damps it on a timescale which is quite considerably shorter than the migration time, actually.
Uh-huh.
And I think in that case, you would only get resonant locking. You probably wouldn't get very much scattering at all.
Yeah, but
because the system tends towards a state in which you actually obtain a constant ratio of eccentricity depending on both the combination of eccentricity damping times and also the migration time. So, anyhow, we can discuss this.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I want to encourage this.
Sure.
Okay, because what I want to encourage is people actually poke at each other's weaknesses, including your own.
Yeah,
okay?
Sure.
Because we're not here to demonstrate how smart we are,
how
accomplished we have done our work. And this is meant to be a progress. Okay, I really would like to encourage this and friendly discussion.
Yeah.
I know there's an opposite viewpoint from back of the room, and then I would like to have him express his view.
Well, let me just respond one other thing. What you said applies mostly to the outer planet. The inner planet is going to be much less effectively damped, right? Yeah. And the other thing that you see is that other people have found that sometimes you go through the 3-1 and enter into the 2-1. And the 2-1 is more robust when you get there. But in the simulations and the setup that I did here, the you tend to stay in the 3-to-1 until one leaves. And I have the student in the process of quantifying, you know, how often you go to 2-to-1 and such. But yeah, no, certainly if you damp them, I mean, the other limit, if you damp them instantly, then you'll never scatter. So absolutely, you know. I guess the question then becomes to do an honest calculation of what the disk damping should be. But well,
In fact, my view is not opposite. It's actually quite similar to. But since you encourage this, I'll say more or less. The problem is that indeed, if you look on the standard torque formula and the way they damp the eccentricity and they change the semi-major axis, you find that the eccentricity evolution timescale is shorter than the semi-major axis timescale by 1 power of the semi-major axis over the width of the gap. Now, these planets are really big, so their gaps are really, really huge. But maybe there is still a factor of 3 or even 4 between the damping timescale of the eccentricity to the semi-major axis evolution. Well, I said damping and I didn't mean the evolution timescale of the eccentricity and the evolution of the semi-major axis. So I agree with him that that assumption is a weak point in this. Now, the point is that it's not clear whether the eccentricity actually damps or gets excited. But if the eccentricity evolution timescale is shorter than that of the semi-major axis, then there is no way out. You will damp no matter what you do with the other planets, as long as the disk is there. So therefore, I think the only solution is that the eccentricity must be excited. And we examine that, and we go to the conclusion that under reasonable condition, it does.
Yeah.
So I understand your starting point in the time scale is quite what I remember finding in our work with Eric Ford. For two planets scattering, we always found that because of collisions, we could not get large eccentricities. Now the disk and eccentricity damping, and somehow you find a lot more high eccentricities. Where does that come from?
Well, again, it comes from the same scenario that I described before. Well, there's two things. The scattering part of it gives you a wide distribution of eccentricity.
No, it doesn't.
Well,
you start much closer to the sun.
Well, but eventually, if you scatter, you must come close.
Therefore, the semi-major axis, the energy of the potential.
But it doesn't matter. With two planets, if you're going to kick one out, in the end, they must have a close interaction. And the problem is that to get them close enough to have that strong interaction, you end up almost always with a physical collision.
That's the key parameter is the ratio of the semi-major axis to the planetary radius.
Yeah.
If you're starting near 180, you would, yes, you'd be at 11.2. But if you start at 5 to 30, you would.
Yeah.
So you must get your strong interactions to actually happen far out, typically before you get a lot of migration in. Is that then what you see?
Yeah. Well, again, there's two different problems that I presented the results to. So let me make sure I quote the result. Okay. In the 10 planet case, I'm starting everything in the outer solar system, and the scattering wins over collisions, just like you said. Okay. And there you get a nice robust distribution of eccentricity, no problem. In the two planet case, it's slightly different. I have two planets and they're surfing in together. And if you don't damp the eccentricity, then the eccentricity will grow. So the key question comes back to what is the eccentricity damping or growth? When I've given this talk before, the naysayers in the audience always said, well, not that the eccentricity damping timescale would be much more effective, but rather that the eccentricity would grow anyway, and that you would get even more eccentricity and more scattering than what I said. So there's a bit of contradiction in the feedback here. I'd like to see what Ward has to say about this, because you've worked on this.
Well, I think
if you don't mind me calling on you.
I think there are cases where you can get growth and cases where you can get damping. I think, you know, depending on what the details of the disk, I'm sorry. What the details of the disk structure is, you can have either case. But one of the things that wasn't clear to me was, you know, when you filled the AE space,
yeah,
the only way you can do that is you must be stopping the process. So what is the method that you're using to stop the process?
Oh, well, there's two ways. What the simulation does is two things. I integrate an honest integration until one of the planets is scattered, or when I reach a million-year stopping time. So I assume that my inner, disk has a finite lifetime, okay?
Yeah, but is the disk's finite lifetime somehow correlated with the ejection timescale?
Well, there's two different timescales. There's a total, a maximum disk lifetime of a million years. So I integrate the integrations until either one planet leaves or I reach a million years, at which time I'm left with two planets. Now, for those that eject a planet before my million years is up, I then say that there's some probability that the disk will live longer than that, and it will just continue to torque that one planet for that remaining time. So I choose a random disk lifetime and evolve the planet forward accordingly.
Okay. Well, then.
Now, you can play around with various prescriptions for doing that. In all cases, well, not in all cases, in almost all cases, you fill the AE plane robustly. There's some question as to which way fits the observations better. But as I said, we don't really know what the distributions and selection effects are for the observations, so it's...
But when you assume the disk is gone, you assume that it's gone globally?
Well, no, I'm only assuming it stops shoving the planet. I mean, it can still be there producing an infrared access and such. So it depends.
No, well, I'm just talking about the dynamics, though.
Yeah, dynamically, I just assume it peters out and no longer pushes on the planet after some finite lifetime. But the finite lifetime is a random number. It's not.
Well, it'd be interesting to see some cases where maybe you make that assumption in a different way. Like, for instance, maybe there's photodissociation that removes the disk from the inside out or something like that, and see what effect this has.
Yeah, that'd be interesting, though.
Physically, it doesn't seem to make much sense that a disk would disappear if there's a planet inside it, keeping it from disappearing. But one way it could disappear if the planet actually gets a very high inclination relative to the disk plane. You can sort of imagine stuff going sort of sneaking through.
Well, you can have accretion through a gap. Is Pavel here? He's done that. Oh, yeah, you've done that too.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Following up on Bill's question, is that, this runs for a million years. And most of the planets around stars are about several billion years old. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, if you were to go on with, such a filled A and E diagram to begin with,
What
happens after that 1 million years to today?
Oh, well, what happens is that the ones that have very short periastron will become more circularized. So you're going to lose the ones in the upper left-hand corner, or you'll move the ones in the left-hand corner down. I'm assuming the disk is gone after a million years, which you can fight with, right? But given that I've assumed that, then the disk will no longer do anything because it ain't there anymore.
So the distribution you produce may not necessarily be the final distribution.
Right, there will be evolution, and there will be evolution because of circularization. And there could, in fact, for some of the systems, they could, in fact, be unstable on a long time scale. So if some of the systems are left with two planets, and if you wait a billion years, some of those planets can be ejected. So you could lose further planets beyond that.
Mike?
One of the few diagnostics you get so far is that it's a different distribution for the planets with M sun I greater than 2 Jupiter mass and those less. And they clearly separate and in fact interior to 60 or 70 days, there were no big planets, only little guys. Do you have anything?
Oh, I haven't actually taken my argument is that if you go back to a plot like this. We only have 100 planets, right? So if I just, in terms of statistics and distributions, if you imagine dividing a plane like this, don't work into 10 boxes this way and 10 boxes this way, then you have 100 boxes in the plane. You have one planet in each box on average. Yeah. So to further fine, you know, to take finer gradations of those distributions, I think it's premature. Yeah, maybe. Oh, so we could look at one and the other. I haven't done that yet, simply because I wanted there to be more planets in general before we could do. But that's something that should be done in the future.
Yeah, independently of the problems of eccentricity dating, I'm concerned by the migration formula that you've used, because they are presumably those computed analytically for circular orbits. So at high eccentricity, things may be very different.
Yes.
In some cases, I believe someone showed that migration could even be reversed.
Yeah, well, the eccentricity damping time will also depend on, you said this when you were the editor for the paper, in fact, that the eccentricity will, in fact, the damping time scale should be a function of the eccentricity, so that it might damp more efficiently when you get up to higher eccentricity. I don't know of anyone who's done an honest calculation of that.
No, but they were speaking about the semi-major axis migration.
Oh, okay.
A dot. Does it depend on eccentricity? Because you presumably use a formula for the circular case, right?
Yeah, no, I just use a straight damping formalism, so I do something very, very simple.
No.
I just...
You didn't take any inclination into account? So things got scattered off, didn't get out of the disk, just kind of the same thing?
Yes. This is just a preliminary demonstration that you can fill the plane, so yes.
Ejections as a result of simply being trapped in the 3-to-1 mean motion resonance.
Yes.
You do. Oh.
Yeah.
Really? I just want to make a comment towards Maurice's remark about the semi-major axis damping. I mean, this numerical simulations, as I will show some of them today in the afternoon, in fact, they show that you can have, even though the eccentricity is growing, you have relatively constant semi-major axis damping over a very long time. So this is not so strongly affected. I think this is, to the first order, probably independent on the eccentricity. That's what I see.
I was just wondering, what's the fraction of your system that are actually still in resonance at the end of your calculation?
Oh, well, only about 20 to 30%, depending on which version of it. I've done several different incarnations of it. 20 to 30% retain two planets. Okay? The rest have ejected
one. Drove one into... So,
and then most of that 20 to 30% will remain in resonance.
Because I'm wondering, part of it may be that you're filling the plane because your migration time scale, so you're stopping the migration at a certain point when it's, you know, the eccentricities are growing, and then you stop it, so you may be filling the plane partly for that reason.
Yeah, and I mean, if you continue them forever, you would shove all the planets into the star, so. Most of them do. Most of them.
Jack, but before Jack starts, I want to encourage those people who are shy, whose English is not so good, like mine, and shy like me. Please speak up, and don't worry about silly things you have to say. I think it's most important we're here to actively contribute to the progress of the team. Yeah.
I can see how things can be driven into the star in a 3-to-1 resonance. I can't see how they can be ejected. In general, I just can't see how these type resonances can change energy substantially. So it's a question for both of you.
Well, we had a talk by various people, I think, who talked about the point about resonance is that there's energy exchange. Otherwise, you have, you know, it's only secular correlation, that is. Especially when eccentricity build up like this, you can hop from resonance to resonance. You're only thinking of the low eccentricity limit, he's thinking about the high eccentricity.
The plus potential.
That's how you. But even without closing contact, you can still pop them up, right? And I think this is some area you may look at.
No, but if you don't have a close encounter, if you're in a Clairaut potential, the energy is
function only of the semi-major axis,
yes.
And there, and the period is a function only of the semi-major axis.
Yes.
So you're in a mean motion resonance. You're not changing
that's
the
not
energy.
Well, I see hand shaping. Okay.
If you're at high eccentricity, the mean motion resonance
overlaps. You hop from
one resonance. That's fine if you're doing from one resonance to another, but if you're ejecting it from the 3 to 1.
Well, I think it depends what you mean by ejecting it from the 3 to 1. Yeah, I think, well, the point is that you're never... If you try to make one of the standard dynamical, you know, resonance things, when you're really in resonance, you know, you're librating around a little tiny area in that plane, right? These things are much more, since the eccentricities are large and they're chaotic and close together, you're never in that nice 3 to 1 resonance. You're only in 3 to 1 resonance in the sense that if I take the ratio of center major axis, I get, you know, 3 to 3/2 power. But you're never actually in a nice textbook kind of resonance. You're just wildly vibrating around that every which way. And as the eccentricity gets pumped up, it's easy to kick something out. So you might not want to use the words that you're ejecting it from a 3 to 1 resonance. What I mean to say is that if I take the ratio of periods, they stay close to 3 to 1 for a long time, and one planet still nonetheless gets ejected. So it's not quite it's not quite being ejected from a resonance. But it still happens, right? I
would just say that it's already happened. We can say that eccentricity for that is high. The resonance is not protecting funds from having it.
Right. You have plus and minus. The resonance is going to drive you to get the plus and
minus. I think Willy had the calculations where things, the semi-major axis, can increase substantially without closing costs. Isn't that correct?
Yes, I mean, everything has been covered, I would say. So the simulations show also that planets can be driven to very high eccentricities, and that, on the other hand, it depends crucially on the disk lifetime also. I mean, you may,
yes.
If you still have some damping present in the resonance, you may be stable, but if you take the disk away at this instant, for example, then the whole system is unstable. Immediately. So then one planet may be ejected just by taking the disk away, and this is included also. So I think certainly all well covered.
Yeah, I mean, one way to see it is that if you look at the cost of books like Murray and Dermal, they plot the width of resonances. Here is the ratio of mean motion. Here is eccentricity. And once you're up, that's high eccentricity, you overlap, you know, all the resonances overlap. And you don't know who you belong to.
I don't think I need
I think it's very unlikely that if you're in that high eccentricity state, that chaotic scene, that you're actually going to get ejections while you're in that chaotic scene. I can see getting a lot of some major axis migration. But my guess is that when a planet leaves the system, probably follows eventual disappearance, which I think is what Jack's been trying to say. And I mean, allow them to talk.
Okay, well, I can go back through and analyze the results and figure out whether you want to say... I mean, one can go back through the results and analyze the dynamics, because that's an interesting dynamical question to see exactly how it is that the planet, how its orbital elements evolve to the point where it gets ejected. At the end of the day, it's going to give you the same AE plane result. It did get ejected, right? I mean, I'm not too worried that there's an error in the code that way.
Well, it makes a difference, because if you've seen a cluster, if you go through close encounter ejection, in a cluster environment, they just get kicked out. Okay, of the cluster as well as the planetary system, you'll never be able to form free flow. Okay, they just don't attach. If they go out, climb out the gravitational potential up, gradually, you will get.
That's how the classical
morph platform is. It's relatively small object, right?
anyway.
Go. These planets are relative to quantum right now.
So the big guys, the ones that are out there, are free floaters or several Jupiter planets.
So getting back to the issue of looking at the coverage in the AE plane, one of the issues is that your stopping mechanism for migration is essentially the disk disappears. But of course, the time scale for planets to be ejected depends on the planetary masses, as your first plot showed.
Yes.
And so I'd be interested in looking at kind of how, as you change the total mass in the system and that time scale changes, how that affects the time scale of the planet migration and planet scattering to take effect versus the disk lifetime, and what kind of effect that would have on the A plane, if that has consequences for say major axes and mass ratios and so forth.
Okay, well, was that a question or?
It's a question if you can answer it.
Yeah, well, I don't think I've done it.
Well, before my head gets chopped off, I sue. And I think we should have some coffee, but we're going to continue. There are many more discussions like this.
Oh, before we stop, actually, I would like to say one more thing. If I might take all of your comments, since this is supposed to be a workshop, right? If I might take all of your comments in summary, it seems like the two things we'd like to know more are what the evolution of, well, basically the disk damping time is, or disk damping rate as a function of time, the torquing as a function of time, and the eccentricity damping as a function of time. The first is just the disk lifetime in the way that I've implemented it here, and the second has to do with the way the eccentricity thing. But I think if you, I would like to see if you gave me those two functions, you know, basically torquing as a function of time and eccentricity damping as a function of time, that everything else that I described here, I mean, then we just do the calculation, right? Those are the two. What's that?
That.
Yeah, right, but those are the two things that I think you guys as an audience are telling me that we want to know best, right? And I just, am I getting it right?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you answer before I get sued? Let's call it. Go that way.